All right, welcome to the deep dive. Today we're going to be diving into the world of machine translation, which probably hits pretty close to home for you right now as you get ready for that final exam.
Absolutely. And it's really about, how do we teach computers to translate between languages, which is a fascinating challenge.
Yeah, I mean, you think about human translation, right? It's almost like this art form, you're capturing all the nuance, the cultural context. But machine translation, right now at least, is much more about just getting the message across, making sure you can communicate.
It's about enabling access to information and communication at scale.
Yeah.
And that's really where we see it being used a lot, right? If you think about, have you ever needed to translate a web page really quickly, whether it's instructions or a news article?
Oh, absolutely. I feel like I'm using Google Translate almost every day.
Right. And that's machine translation in action, right?
Yeah.
It's become essential for accessing all kinds of information, like recipes, Wikipedia articles, even government pages.
It's everywhere, right? It's, I mean, just the scale of it. Google Translate alone, I think, processes more words in a day than you could read in a lifetime.
It's a massive amount of data. And I think one of the really exciting aspects is how it has the potential to really reduce the digital divide in
Yeah.
terms of information access.
Yeah, right. Because so much of the world's knowledge is, concentrated in a few languages. So if we can accurately translate that into other languages, it just opens up so much possibility.
It makes information available to a much wider audience.
So how does it actually work, this magic? The core of most machine translation systems is an algorithm called an encoder-decoder network, or you might hear it called a sequence-to-sequence model.
Yeah, essentially it maps an input sequence, which is our source language, into an output sequence, which is our target language.
So, like taking, a sentence in English and turning it into, I don't know, Spanish or something.
Exactly. And it's not just about substituting words one to one. Different languages have very different structures,
Right. Yeah.
Think about this simple English sentence. He wrote a letter to a friend. Subject, verb, object,
Yeah.
right?
Right.
But in Japanese, it would be something like Tomodachi ni tegami o kaita, which is subject, object, verb, and they even drop the pronoun he, because it's often implied from the context.
And I think we had that example from the UN document, right? Where.
Yes, where the original Chinese was something like peaceful using outer space conference of suggestions, which then got translated into English as suggestions of the dot conference on the peaceful use of outer space.
I mean, just look at that, right? The word order is almost completely flipped.
Yeah, English adds function words like the and on, which don't have direct equivalents in Chinese. And the way plurals are marked is completely different. And even capitalization conventions can differ.
It's amazing, right, that these encoder-decoder networks can figure all that out.
It really highlights their ability to learn these complex mappings between sequences.
So today, in this deep dive, I think our mission is to really solidify this knowledge for you, give you a foundation for that exam.
Yeah, we want to give you a deep understanding.
So we'll start by talking about language variation, all the ways languages can be different.
Right. Then we'll break down that encoder-decoder algorithm, look at how the text is processed, how these massive training data sets are created, and then the real nitty-gritty of how the encoder and the decoder work.
And then finally, we got to talk about how we actually evaluate, how good these machine translations are.
Absolutely. Evaluation is key.
All right, so let's start at the beginning, right? There are what, like 7,000 languages in the world? It's crazy.
Yeah. Around that number. And what's amazing is that despite this incredible diversity, there are also some universal features, some commonalities that we see across almost all languages.
Really? Like what kind of things?
Well, every language seems to have words for people, words for eating, ways to express politeness.
Right.
And structurally, we see things like nouns and verbs, ways to form questions and give commands, and mechanisms for indicating agreement.
That's interesting. So there's this underlying commonality despite all the surface differences.
Absolutely. And it's those surface differences that lead to what we call translation divergence.
Translation divergence. Okay.
Yeah, it basically refers to all the ways languages differ, which make word-for-word translation basically impossible most of the time.
Gotcha.
So we can think about these divergences along a spectrum.
Yeah.
At one end, you have these idiosyncratic or lexical differences. These are just one-off variations, like different words for the same thing, like the word for dog in English versus, say, Basque. It's totally different. You just have to learn it.
So those are kind of like the exceptions to the rules.
In a way, yes. But then at the other end, we have systematic differences. These are patterns in the structure of a language that we can actually model with rules and algorithms.
Okay.
And a classic example of that is word order, subject, verb, object, like English, or subject, object, verb, like Japanese.
Right, right. And that whole field of studying these patterns is called linguistic typology, right?
Exactly. It's basically categorizing languages based on these structural tendencies. And there's a fantastic resource for that called WALS, the World Atlas of Language Structures.
WALS. Okay, cool. So let's dig into those word order differences a little more. You mentioned SVO and SOV, but there's also VSO, right? Like Arabic?
Yes. Verb, subject, object. And often, languages with a particular word order tend to have other related grammatical features. For example, languages where the verb comes before the object, we call them VO languages.
VO.
They often use prepositions, so in, on, to, which come before the noun phrase. But OV languages, where the verb comes after the object, they tend to use postpositions, which come after the noun phrase.
So it's like the whole language kind of flips around in a way?
Yeah, there's these interesting correlations. And we saw that in the English-Japanese example, right?
Right, right. To a friend in English versus tomodachi-ni in Japanese. The preposition versus postposition. And what about Arabic? Where does that fit in?
Arabic is VSO, so verb first, then subject, then object. And being a VO language, it uses prepositions, just like English. So a sentence like, he wrote a letter to a friend would be something like, kataba risalatan li sadikin in Arabic. Verb, then the letter, then to the friend.
Okay, that makes sense. But are there other word order variations that, that machine translation has to deal with?
Oh, absolutely. Even within SVO languages, like English and French, the placement of things like adjectives can differ.
Hmm.
In English, we say Greenwich, but in Spanish, it's Bruja Verde, adjective after the noun.
Interesting.
And then you have languages like German, where adverbs can often go at the beginning of the sentence, the main verb goes second, or Mandarin, which often puts prepositional phrases before the verb, unlike English.
So all these little differences can really add up and make translation tricky.
Absolutely. MT systems have to do a lot of reordering behind the scenes.
Okay, so we've got word order down. Now let's talk about the words themselves, right? Lexical divergences.
Right. So lexical divergence is all about how languages choose to represent concepts with words. And it's not always a one-to-one mapping.
Like we were talking about with bass in English.
Exactly. Bass can be a fish or a low musical tone. And the correct translation into, say, Spanish would be totally different depending on the context.
So it's not just about knowing the words, it's about understanding the meaning.
Exactly. And this is where word sense disambiguation comes in. The MT system needs to figure out which sense of the word is intended in the source language to choose the right translation.
Word sense disambiguation. Okay.
Yeah, it's a key part of the process. And then you have cases where a language might have grammatical requirements that influence word choice. Like, English distinguishes between singular and plural nouns, while Mandarin often doesn't.
Right.
Or in French and Spanish, adjectives have gender, which has to agree with the noun. That's something we don't have in English.
And then there's the many-to-many mappings, right?
Yes. This is where one word in one language can map to several different words in another language, depending on the context.
Like,
Think about the English words leg, foot, and paw.
Okay.
If we're translating into French, the correct word would depend on what we're talking about. An animal's leg would be pat, but a leg of a journey would be a top, and a leg of a chair would be pied.
Wow. That's a lot for a translation system to keep track of.
It is. And sometimes a language simply lacks a word for a concept that exists in another language. That's what we call a lexical gap.
A lexical gap. Okay.
Yeah. So English doesn't have a single word to capture the meaning of the Mandarin word xiao, which is often translated as filial piety.
So you need to use a whole phrase to explain it.
Right. And then there are systematic differences in how languages encode information about events within their verbs. The linguist Leonard Talmy observed this distinction between what he called verb-framed languages and satellite-framed languages.
Verb-framed and satellite-framed. I'm intrigued.
So this is specifically about expressing motion. In verb-framed languages, the main verb typically encodes the direction of motion.
Okay.
While manner of motion is expressed separately, like with an adverb. So in Spanish, you might say, la botella salió flotando, which is literally the bottle exited floating.
So the verb salió means exited, and that's where the direction is.
Exactly. And flotando tells you the manner, floating.
Okay, I see. So how is that different in satellite frame languages?
In those languages, the direction of motion is often indicated by a separate particle or preposition that goes with the verb. So in English, we would say the bottle floated out.
Ah, okay. So the direction is in that out, which is like a little satellite around the verb.
Exactly. And interestingly, a lot of Romance languages, like Spanish, are verb framed, while a lot of non-Romance in Indo-European languages, like English, are satellite framed. But there are exceptions on both sides.
So it's not a hard and fast rule, but more of a general tendency.
Right.
Okay, we've done word order, we've done lexical choices. Let's move on to morphology. What's that all about?
Morphology is the study of the internal structure of words. You know how words are formed from smaller units of meaning called morphemes?
Morphemes, okay.
Yeah, and there are two main dimensions to consider here. First, how many morphemes are there per word on average? And second, how easily can we segment these morphemes? Can we separate them out neatly?
Okay, so for the number of morphemes, what kind of variation do we see?
Well, you have languages like Vietnamese and Cantonese, which are very isolating. Most words are just a single morpheme.
Okay.
And at the other extreme, you have these polysynthetic languages like Siberian Yupik, where a single word can be incredibly complex with many morphemes packed in, expressing what might take a whole sentence in English.
Wow, that's intense. And what about that segmentability dimension?
So you have languages like Turkish, which are agglutinative. The morphemes are added one after another, and the boundaries are pretty clear. But then you have fusion languages, like Russian, where a single morpheme can encode multiple grammatical features all at once. Like in the Russian word stolom, meaning table, the om ending indicates the instrumental case, singular number, and a particular gender.
So it's like a morpheme multitasker.
Exactly. And for machine translation, this means that when we're dealing with morphologically rich languages, we can't just treat words as single units. We need to use subword models, which break words down into smaller parts.
Subword models, gotcha.
Yeah, things like word piece or BPE, bipair encoding.
And finally, let's talk about referential density.
Referential density is all about how explicitly a language expresses reference. Things like pronouns.
Yeah.
So English, for example, usually requires you to have a pronoun. But other languages, called pro-drop languages, allow you to drop the pronoun when it's clear from the context. Like Spanish, you might say, the boss found a book, showed his discovery. And you don't need to explicitly say, he showed the discovery.
Right. The verb conjugation tells you who it is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And even among pro-drop languages, there's variation. Japanese and Chinese tend to drop pronouns even more than Spanish.
Yeah.
So we have this concept of referential density. Languages that use pronouns more are hot languages. They're more explicit. Languages that drop them more are cold, more reliant on inference.
That's an interesting way to think about it. Hot and cold languages.
Yeah, and it has implications for machine translation.
Yeah.
Because if you're translating from a pro-drop language to a non-pro-drop language, the system needs to figure out who that missing pronoun refers to.
Which can be tough if the context isn't clear.
Exactly.
All right, so we've covered a lot of ground on just how diverse languages are.
A lot of things to consider.
Now let's get into the nitty-gritty of how machine translation actually works using this encoder-decoder framework.
Right, let's delve into that.
So remind me again, what's the standard architecture called?
It's the encoder-decoder transformer, or you might hear it called a sequence-to-sequence model. And for simplicity, we often think about translating each sentence independently. So our task is, given a source sentence, generate a target sentence that means the same thing.
So the green witch arrived becomes Llegó la bruja verde in Spanish.
Exactly.
But how does the system actually learn to do that?
So MT relies on supervised machine learning, meaning we need a lot of data. Specifically, we need parallel text, which is basically a bunch of sentence pairs where each sentence in one language is paired with its translation in another language.
Okay, so the system learns by looking at tons of examples.
Right, and during training, the goal is to maximize the probability of generating the correct sequence of words, or actually tokens, in the target language, given the input sequence of tokens in the source language.
Tokens. So we're not always working with whole words.
No, we often break sentences down into smaller units, which we call tokens. These can be words, but also parts of words or even individual characters.
Okay. So we feed the system. The green witch arrived. It breaks it down into tokens and then learns to predict the sequence of tokens that make up Llegó la bruja verde.
Precisely.
And you said this all happens through the encoder-decoder architecture.
Right. So we have these two main components, the encoder and the decoder. The encoder's job is to take the input sequence of tokens and create a compressed representation of the whole sentence. We call this the context vector. or just Iki.
So the encoder is like summarizing the meaning of the sentence.
Exactly. And then the decoder uses that context vector to generate the output sequence token by token.
Okay, so the encoder summarizes, the decoder translates.
In a nutshell, yes.
So let's talk about how this tokenization actually works. You mentioned using subword tokens. Why is that better than just using whole words?
So MT systems usually work with a fixed vocabulary, a predefined set of tokens they can handle. If we only used whole words, we'd run into problems with rare words or words the system hasn't seen before.
It wouldn't know what to do with them.
Right. Subword tokenization helps with that. It breaks down words into smaller, more frequent units. So even if the system hasn't seen the whole word, it might have seen the parts.
Makes sense.
And often we use a shared vocabulary for both the source and target languages. This helps with things like proper nouns or technical terms that might appear in both.
So like Shakespeare would be the same token in English and French.
Exactly. Plus, using subword tokens helps us handle languages that don't use spaces between words, like Chinese or Thai.
Okay, so that's the basic idea, but you mentioned there are different ways to do this subword tokenization, like word piece and unigram.
Right, so BPE, which is the basic byte pair encoding, just merges the most frequent adjacent tokens. But word piece, which is used in BERT, makes merging decisions based on what results in the biggest improvement to a language model.
So it's more linguistically informed.
Exactly. And then unigram, which is used in ALBERT and T5, starts with a huge vocabulary, and then iteratively removes tokens based on how much their removal affects the probability of the training data.
And why is unigram sometimes better than BPE?
Well, BPE can sometimes create these really short, meaningless tokens. It also tends to merge common suffixes really aggressively.
Mm.
Unigram often gives you more meaningful units. Like, instead of splitting unlikely into un and likely, it might keep them as separate tokens, or even keep unlikely as a single token if it's common enough.
Interesting.
So you end up with more linguistically meaningful building blocks.
All right, we've tokenized our text. Now we need the data to train our model, these massive parallel corpora or byte texts, right?
Exactly. Parallel corpora are collections of documents where each document, or often each sentence, in one language is aligned with its translation in another language.
Okay. And where do we get this data?
We have governmental and international organizations like the European Parliament and the UN that produce tons of multilingual documents.
Right.
And then we have movie and TV subtitles. And we can also crawl the web and try to align text from different language versions of websites.
So lots of sources for this data. But what if we're dealing with a language pair that's not as common, where we don't have all these readily available resources?
That's where sentence alignment comes in. If we have two documents that are translations of each other, but the sentences aren't explicitly linked, we need to figure out which sentence in the source language corresponds to which sentence in the target language.
Okay, so we need to match them up. And how do we do that?
It usually involves two steps. First, we need a cost function. This function gives us a score for how likely it is that a particular chunk of source sentences is a translation of a particular chunk of target sentences.
Okay.
And then we use an alignment algorithm to find the best overall alignment, the one that minimizes this cost.
So how do we calculate this cost, this likelihood that two sentences are translations of each other?
A common way is to use multilingual embedding spaces. These are spaces where sentences with similar meanings, even in different languages, are close to each other. So we can measure the cosine similarity between the embeddings of a source sentence and a target sentence.
And a higher similarity means they're more likely to be translations.
Exactly.
Okay. And what kind of algorithm do we use to actually find this best alignment?
Dynamic programming techniques are common. These are the same kind of techniques used in algorithms like minimum edit distance.
Okay.
And then once we have our aligned data, we usually need to do some cleanup.
Yeah.
Because especially if we're getting data from the web, there can be a lot of noise.
Right. Things that aren't actually translations or are just bad translations.
Yeah. So we can apply rules to filter out bad pairs, like pairs that are too short or too long, or pairs that have too many words that are the same, which might mean they're duplicates. We can also use the cosine similarity of their embeddings as a filter, discarding pairs that have very low similarity.
Okay, so we've talked about tokenization and how we get the data. Now let's finally get into the heart of it all, the encoder-decoder model itself.
All right, let's dive in. So as we said, it's based on the transformer architecture.
The transformer, right.
And it has two main parts. The encoder and the decoder, both built on that transformer architecture.
Okay.
The encoder takes the source sentence, broken down into tokens, and processes it through these layers of self-attention and feed-forward neural networks.
Okay, so it's analyzing the sentence.
Right. And its output is a sequence of encoded representations, which we often call HH.
Got it. And what does the decoder do with that?
So the decoder is also a transformer, but it has this extra component called a cross-attention layer.
Cross-attention, okay.
Yeah, you might also hear it called encoder-decoder attention, or source attention.
Okay.
And the decoder acts as a conditional language model. It uses HINC, the encoded representation of the source sentence, along with the previously generated target tokens, to predict the next token in the target sequence.
So it generates the translation word by word.
Exactly. And this cross-attention layer is what allows it to focus on the relevant parts of the source sentence at each step.
It's looking back at the original sentence and saying, okay, what do I need to translate next?
Precisely.
And how does this cross-attention actually work?
It's similar to the self-attention you find in the encoder and decoder. It involves these queries, keys, and values.
Right, right.
But in cross-attention, the queries come from the decoder, while the keys and values come from the encoder, from HINC.
Okay.
And by calculating attention weights based on the similarity between these queries and keys, the decoder can focus on the parts of the source sentence that are most important for predicting the next target token.
So if the decoder is trying to generate the Spanish word for which, it can specifically look at the part of HINC that represents the English word which.
It's a great way to think about it. It's a very dynamic way of aligning the source and target languages.
Very cool.
And the decoder also has its own self-attention layer. But this one is causal, meaning it can only attend to the tokens that have already been generated in the target sequence. So it maintains that left-to-right generation order.
Okay, so it can't peek ahead at what it's going to generate next.
Right. Whereas the encoder's self-attention can look at the whole source sentence at once.
Gotcha. And how is this whole encoder-decoder model trained?
So it's trained using self-supervision. We have our massive parallel corpus, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we feed the model a source sentence and ask it to predict the corresponding target sentence, token by token.
Okay.
And at each step, the model calculates a probability distribution over all the possible target token.
Okay.
And the goal is to minimize the difference between this predicted distribution and the actual target token.
Okay.
And we often use a technique called teacher forcing during training. This means that at each step, we give the model the correct previous target token as input.
So it's like we're guiding it along.
Exactly. It helps stabilize the training and makes learning faster.
All right. So we've trained our model. Now we want to use it to translate a new sentence. How does that work?
That's the decoding process. And one simple way to do decoding is greedy decoding.
Greedy decoder. Okay.
Yeah. At each step, you just pick the token with the highest probability and add it to the translation. But this can lead to suboptimal results, especially for long sentences.
Because a word that seems good at the beginning might not be the best choice in the long run.
Exactly. It's like making a short-sighted decision in a chess game.
Gotcha.
So for MT, we often use something called beam search.
Beam search.
Beam search keeps track of multiple possible partial translations at each step. We call this the beam width, usually denoted by K.
So if we set K to 3, it's keeping track of the 3 most promising translations so far.
Exactly. And at each step, for each of these hypotheses, it predicts the probability distribution over the target vocabulary.
Okay.
Then it calculates a score for each new hypothesis, usually the product of the probabilities of all the tokens generated so far. And it keeps only the top K hypotheses.
So it's exploring multiple possibilities in parallel.
Right. It's like searching through a tree where each branch represents a possible word. And we're pruning the tree at each step to keep only the most promising branches.
Makes sense.
And we usually score these hypotheses using log probabilities, which helps avoid numerical issues.
Okay.
And then at the end, we pick the hypothesis with the highest overall score. But there's a catch. Longer hypotheses tend to have lower probabilities just because they have more tokens. So we often normalize the scores by dividing by the length of the hypothesis. This way, we're comparing the average probability per word.
Okay.
And the beam width, K, is usually set to something between 5 and 10.
So it's exploring a handful of possibilities at each step.
Right.
You also mentioned something called minimum Bayes risk decoding. What's the idea behind that?
So MBR decoding is about choosing the translation that's likely to have the least error according to some evaluation metric. It's less about finding the most probable translation and more about finding the safest option.
Okay.
So you generate a bunch of candidate translations, and then you pick the one that's most similar on average to all the other candidates.
So it's like taking a vote among the candidates.
In a way, yes.
Yeah.
And this has been shown to work well in practice.
Interesting. So far, we've mostly been talking about situations where we have a lot of data, but what about low-resource scenarios where we don't have these massive parallel corpora?
That's a huge challenge. There's a big disparity in resources between languages like English and many other languages. And even for high-resource languages, there might be specific domains where data is scarce.
So what do we do in those cases?
Two common approaches are back translation and multilingual models.
Okay.
Back translation is a way to create more data. We use monolingual data in the target language, and we use a reverse translation system to translate it into the source language.
So we're using a translation system to create more training data for another translation system.
Exactly. It's a way to augment our data, even if the translations aren't perfect.
That's clever.
And it works surprisingly well.
Okay, and what about multilingual models?
Multilingual models are single models trained on data from many different language pairs. And the idea is that they can learn these shared representations and transfer knowledge between languages. So a model trained on Spanish English and a little bit of Galician English might be able to translate Galician English better than a model only on Galician English.
Because it can use what it learned from the Spanish English data to help with the Galician.
Exactly.
That's really cool. All right, we've trained our MT system. Now, how do we know if it's any good?
Right. We need to evaluate it.
So what are the main things we look at when evaluating a machine translation?
Two main aspects, adequacy and fluency.
Okay.
Adequacy is about how well the translation captures the meaning of the original sentence.
So is it accurate?
Right. And fluency is about how natural the translation is in the target language. Is it grammatical? Is it easy to read? Does it sound natural?
Okay, so how do we actually measure these things?
The most reliable way is through human evaluation. We have human raters who are fluent in both languages, and they assess the translations. They might give scores or rank different translations.
Right.
And we can also use post-editing, where human editors fix the machine translation, and the amount of editing required tells us something about the quality.
Okay, that makes sense. But human evaluation is expensive, right? You need a lot of people.
Exactly. So we often use automatic evaluation metrics as well. These are algorithms that compare the machine translation to a reference translation.
So they're like a quick and dirty way to get a sense of the quality.
Exactly. They're not perfect, but they're useful. And one common metric is CHRF.
CHR, right. You mentioned that earlier. How does it work?
CHRF stands for Character F Score. And it basically measures the overlap of character engrams between the machine translation and the reference.
Character engrams, okay.
Yeah, so sequences of characters. Like if we have the reference witness for the past and the translation witness of the past, CHRF would look at all the individual characters and all the pairs of characters in both sentences and calculate how much overlap there is.
Okay.
And it does this for different lengths of engrams. It's a simple metric, but it correlates pretty well with human judgments.
And what about BLEU? That's another one I've heard a lot about.
BLEU, which stands for Bilingual Evaluation Understudy, is a word-based metric. It looks at the precision of word engrams in the machine translation compared to the reference.
Okay.
It considers engrams up to length 4, and it has a brevity penalty to discourage translations that are too short. But it's also known to be sensitive to how the text is tokenized, and it doesn't always work well for languages with complex morphology.
So CHRF and BLEU, they give us a number, but how do we know if the difference between two scores is actually meaningful?
Right. So we often use statistical significance tests, things like paired bootstrap resampling or randomization tests. These tests tell us how likely it is that the difference we see is just due to random chance.
Okay, so we need to make sure the difference is statistically significant.
Exactly.
Are there any limitations to these automatic metrics? What might they miss?
Well, absolutely. They're very focused on local overlap. You know, individual words or characters. They might not capture things like the overall flow of the text or whether large phrases have been moved around correctly. And they tend to work best when the systems being compared are producing similar types of translations.